Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New Yorker magazine media critic Ken Oletta knows America's newsrooms and the people who run them and the people who own them. For a long and luminous run, he's been covering the great and powerful and the get-it-done news hounds of the American press. Now he's pulled the last decade of his work together with a warning. In a new collection of his pieces entitled Backstory, Inside the Business of News, Ken Oletta looks at the crumbling Chinese wall that traditionally separated newsrooms and their owners' business agendas. And he searches for the vision that journalism students learn in the classroom but struggle to hold on to in the public companies that hire them, where focus groups, rather than an editor's news sense, may decide what makes page one. Tonight on Point, Ken Oletta and the selling of the news. Are you getting what you want, what you need from the American news media today? Have you come to see the news business as just another business out to make a buck? Does the press still have a sacred trust? Is it exercising that trust? Does it have your trust? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Ken Oletta. He's written his Annals of Communication column and profiles for The New Yorker since 1992. His most recent article there is Fortress Bush, How the White House Keeps the Press Under Control. He's author of 8 books. His new book is Backstory, Inside the Business of News. Good evening and welcome, Ken Oletta.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us tonight. Also with us, with me in the studio tonight, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you right here.
Thank you. Hello, and hello, Mr. Oletta.
Hi.
Ken Oletta, we wait for your articles in The New Yorker with anticipation, and it's an event when they come out, and you've collected a lot of them here across a big range of subjects, plenty on The New York Times in your new book, but also The New York Tabloids and Don Imus and the Chicago Tribune and the American media sort of right across the country. I wonder where in this last decade that you've pulled together in Backstory, where did you begin to see emerging the theme that you've thrown over this at the end of the trouble at the intersection of newsrooms and the business side of the news business?
Actually, it began, I did a book in the for 6 years starting in 85 to 91 called Three Blind Mice, mm-hmm. about the television networks. In the course of reporting that book, I found that the new business people who had taken over the networks, replacing the original owners, General Electric at NBC and Larry Tisch at CBS and Cap Cities at ABC, yeah. were increasingly saying, why can't the news be run in a more efficient way? Why can't it get its ratings up? Why can't we have more sizzle rather than steak? And why do we need all these overseas bureaus, et cetera, et cetera? So in the course of reporting that book, I saw the conflicts and the kind of cultural conflicts that were taking place between newsrooms and the business people who didn't share the same value system as the people in those newsrooms. Then when I started writing about the media in Annals of Communication for The New Yorker in 92, you just pick up on that. And if you do a profile of Rupert Murdoch, which I did in 95, or you do a profile of Ted Turner, or you do a profile of the AOL Time Warner people, or you do a profile of the Viacom people, or if you do a profile of Arthur Sulzberger Jr. at the New York Times, you see these issues writ large all the time. So it's recurring. And it I couldn't date and say this happened in January of X year, but I've lived with it for what seems like a long while.
Just coming up again and again in every story. And we want to hear about some of the anecdotes and moments where you saw that in your reporting over that time tonight. You quote, Ken Oletta, this wonderful passage etched into marble above the Chicago Tribune Towers, fabulous entrance there in Chicago, quoting Abraham Lincoln, etched in marble, saying, "Let the people know the facts and the country will be safe." What's the message you've brought out of your reporting here for us, Ken? Are the people getting the facts? Is the country, as a result, safe? Was there something else going on, and why?
No, the people sometimes get the facts. I mean, a lot of reporters wake up every morning believing they're doing God's work, that they are carrying out a public trust, and try as best they can, imperfectly as that may be, to do that. But increasingly, the business pressures that exist and the pressures to keep your audience larger than it is automatically getting, be it in television land or newspaper land, where circulation and ratings continue to go down, you wind up doing what a carnival barker does. You shout a little louder, you soften the news, you try and entertain people rather than inform them more. And that is going on, and it's very hard to stop. There's a debate that takes place that's very prominent in journalism today. Is the press, does it exhibit a liberal bias? If you listen to people at Fox News or the Wall Street Journal or conservatives, they will say there's a dominant liberal bias. If you talk to people on the left, Al Franken, et cetera, they'll say there's a dominant conservative bias. In fact, the dominant bias, I think, is a market bias. It's a bias for getting those ratings up, for entertaining that audience, for sizzle, for gotcha, for conflict, for horse race coverage. And interestingly enough, this is an analysis that you'll hear an Eric Altman at The Nation make, or Al Franken make in his best-selling book today about
Liar
about
the lying
nature
liars
of the press. And yet I found in going to the White House and interviewing the Bush people, they think there is a liberal bias, but they don't think that's the operative press bias. They actually agree that there's a market bias. They don't use the word market because it has too much of a leftist connotation for them.
Right.
But they believe that the press is in the game of gotcha and is not interested in understanding what goes on, but is interested in the headline.
Well, here's where the theme of your book, Backstory, and the news, what's going on right now, really come together. I mean, you describe the Bush White House as looking at the press and saying, this is not the bearer of a sacred public trust. This is a business like any other. These are special pleaders like any other. All they're out for is a hot headline. And so we have no obligation to respond to them, to treat them in any special way. In fact, if I've got you right, Ken Auletta, you have high officials in the administration saying almost exactly that.
Oh, actually, that's one of the questions I was asking in doing that piece for The New Yorker. Is there something different about this White House from other White Houses? Every White House, and I've actually done this kind of piece in terms of the press and the White House press corps for a number of administrations, starting with Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. Every president complains about the press, and every press corps complains about the president, lack of access, et cetera. Each is paranoid about the other. Each talks about the technological changes that are taking place in newsrooms around the world.
Yeah.
That's not new. What is new, it seems to me, in this White House, and you pinpointed it, they say, in fact, quite openly, that we see you as a special interest. We don't think of you as a neutral referee of the press. We don't see you as performing a vital check and balance function, which is how we often see ourselves. We think of you as a special pleader for headlines, for gotcha, for conflict, for sensationalism. And therefore, we don't have to talk to you. And how does that manifest itself? It actually manifests itself if you look at the number of press conferences George W. Bush has held. He's held 11 in his nearly 3 years in office. His father, in a similar period of time, held about 70. Clinton, who held the least amount of any president since Dwight Eisenhower, had 36. So George W. Bush...
And you go right on back. Eisenhower, 74, JFK, 65, LBJ, 80, even embattled Richard Nixon, 23.
Yeah, and this is a Bush doesn't believe he has to do that. He also believes he doesn't perform particularly well in a press conference. He freezes it before the television cameras, and he has a certain resentment about the kind of questions and the aggressiveness of it all. So he declines to do it.
So here's the question that your latest piece raises when I hold it up against your book, Ken Auletta. Does the press deserve to be treated that way? Because you're essentially making the allegation that, yes, in fact, the business of the news business has taken over the news. Is the Bush administration, the Bush White House, right? Are they correct?
Well, they're right and they're wrong. I think they're, and it is a theme of my book, that the low standing of the press owes a lot to the press's own low behavior, be it sensationalism, be it the focus, including places like CNN, on starting with O.J., but Lacey Peterson or Michael Jackson, or the rolling back of the number of bureaus overseas of all three networks, or be it if it bleeds, it leads on local TV news, or be it the kind of cutbacks that have taken place in investigative reporting of government coverage and local press around the country. So I think there's lots of reasons for the public to hold the press in lower esteem, and lots of reasons for George Bush, like Bill Clinton, like Richard Nixon, like other presidents, to criticize the press. Having said that, the truth is there still are a very good number of reporters who go out every day trying to do a good job and trying to perform that check and balance function to try, as imperfect as it may be, to approximate what is the truth, what is really happening.
No question.
And part of one weapon they have to do that is access to public officials to force them to answer questions on the assumption that we, the press, represent the public.
But what I'm reading here is that on balance, you don't see that as happening as vigorously as it did, as much as it needs to. And I guess the question that comes to mind then, and you look at this from, you know, top level way up where the Titans stand all the way down to the reporters, why is this happening now? I mean, the news business has always been a business. Papers always needed to make a profit to pay the salaries and buy the newsprint and get the trucks out on the road. Why this extra influence now? What's the fundamental dynamic?
Well, the fundamental dynamic, I mean, there are a number of dynamics, but one of the fundamental dynamics is what is happening to the business world. Just start with the networks. If you went back to the early 80s, the three television networks, CBS, ABC, and NBC, galvanized over 90% of the audience on any given night. The newscast, the evening newscast, galvanized that. Today, the networks galvanize far below 50% of that audience. So people have many more choices with digital cable television. My cable, digital cable box, I get 400 or 500 channels on that. And then I get the internet. And on the internet, I can read any newspaper. I no longer rush out to Times Square to buy some overseas newspaper that I heard about some article in. I could read it online. So I have many more choices of for information today. And that's one fundamental difference. Another fundamental difference is that the what I like to call the peopleization of the media, there's this premium for personalities and on the assumption being that that's a way of keeping your audience and keeping it from fleeing.
They'll be familiar. They'll have the hooks in.
Yes. And so we look for anecdotes and worse than that, we look for storylines, for narratives. And there's good to that, but there's also bad to that. And it means it leads to simplification. It leads to people feeling that we're doing cheap psychology 101.
Jack Beattie, join us here. Ken Auletta looks across a pretty good span of time, just about a decade, and across many newsrooms, print and broadcast and the rest. Here's what he brings back, this warning. Watch out. The business is taking over the business. Do you feel it?
Yes, you can see it. In 1983, Ben Bagdikian wrote a book called The Media Monopoly, and in it he pointed out that 50 corporations then owned the bulk of the media, books, newspapers, magazines, TV and radio stations. The number now is 6. There are 6 corporations.
And it was already a monopoly in his mind.
It was already a monopoly in his mind. And so we have that fact, and then we have this other fact that I find the most disturbing thing to come out of the study of the media in some time. That is the misperceptions that the public had about the Iraq War and the influence those misperceptions had on their decision for or against the war, and the source of their misperceptions, that is, what did they rely on to come to them. And the misperceptions, and this is a major study done out of the University of Maryland, of as many as 8,000 respondents over months.
Big poll.
Big poll. And so what they found is that 60% of the public believed one or more of these things, that Iraq was directly involved in September 11th, that weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq, and significant segments of the public even thought they had been used in Iraq against the United States, and that world opinion supported the United States. All of these were flagrant misconceptions. And they found, for example, that 80% of Fox viewers held at least one of these. 71% of CNN, of CBS viewers, 55% of NBC and CNN, 47% of print media people who got most of their news that way, but only 23% of people who relied on NPR and PBS. So we were doing our job. But what's striking here is the correlation of the misperception with the corporate ownership. You can go down the list. As you go less corporate, PBS, of course, foundation, more.
You're saying lines are better. Ken Aletta, we want to come back after a short break and get your response, your view on that. It's terrific to have you with us tonight. We're talking with New Yorker magazine media writer Ken Aletta about the American news business and the journalism it produces and does not produce. Are you getting what you want, what you need from the American news media? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New Yorker magazine media writer Ken Aletta about the American news business and the journalism it produces and does not produce. His new book is Backstory Inside the News Business. Sorry, Ken. I'm not sure if I've got that right.
You got it right.
Yeah, good.
The business of news. Backstory
inside the business of news. Backstory. You can join our conversation when you pick up the morning newspaper, click on the morning news. Who do you think it's serving? A democratic citizenry, the bottom line, the powers that be, your own desire to be titillated, and are you looking for enlightenment or entertainment from the news media, and which are you getting? You could join us, 1-800-423-8255. Ken, what about Jack Beatty's observation here, that there are all kinds of levels of understanding of what's going on in Iraq, and sort of depending on where you get your news, you may have a very different view?
I think there is a measure of blame, as Jack said, corporatization of the media. That is to say, a kind of a dumbing down that's taken place. And it's taken place, the conversation goes something like this, or went something like this and continues like this. We're losing our audience, says the business leader. And the news person says, I know, but we have an obligation to tell them what's really going on. That's what journalism does, he said. And the business person says, that's nonsense. You are losing. You have to entertain. You have to hold on to your audience. You have to make it more accessible to them. So let's liven up the newscast. Let's introduce a little music to that newscast. Let's have more characters. Let's have some lighter stuff, some news you can use. Let's have some. Why don't we have some entertainers on this? Why don't we have some sexy women? Let's do something to keep that audience. So increasingly, the people who the business types were telling the news types, be afraid of your audience. Make it more accessible to them.
Be afraid of them as in don't trust them to desire to buy the real news?
No, don't bore them. Don't you dare risk boring them with a serious story, because you'll lose that audience. And then when that failed to hold the audience, when they continued to lose circulation at the newspapers or magazines or ratings at their television, what they then did said, well, we got to cut costs. And if you cut costs, you start cutting bureaus and you start cutting serious and investigative reports and serious news. So inevitably, you wind up with cheaper news and that doesn't have the kind of in-depth that Jack was talking about, and people become less and less informed. See, one of the fundamental issues here is what is your obligation as a journalist? I mean, if you really are a profession, then you have an obligation to say, I really think this is important for the public to know, and if I'm a professional, that's my job to be able to sort out what is important in democracy to know, even at the risk of boring them. Now, the problem with that position, if you're a news president, or you're an editor of a newspaper, you'll probably get fired if you take it very long because your ratings may go down and your circulation may go down. But that ultimately is what you would ideally like a journalist to do. And it used to be when they were near monopolies, they would do that. And by the way, they still do it at places. The New York Times basically does that. The Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, other newspapers do that. NPR does that.
But the New York Times can range across the whole country to build its circulation. Others, basically, most others, have to build it right in their own backyard, and it's hard. I want to look some more at this livening up issue, but Jack was really – I heard another facet to what Jack was raising, not just that people weren't getting information in depth, but that depending on their source of information, they'd have very different understandings of the news. Jack, if I got you right, you're even suggesting that the kind of corporate impulse behind a particular news operation may end up shaping the way people understand what's going on. Ken Aletta, do you see that kind of biasing also in the news as a product of corporate ownership?
I don't think it. I think it's. There are examples that come to my mind of where corporatization affected the news in a dramatic way. I mean, I think, for instance, that there was a Today Show piece they didn't do on the environment where GE was supposedly polluting in Ohio. This happened about 10 years ago, mm-hmm. But that was self censorship. It wasn't the head of GE reaching down and saying, "Don't do this."
The GE owner of NBC, and there you go.
It was NBC executive who was worried about his job and his contract was doing up, so he self censored that way. And you had that in the Olympic coverage of apologizing to China, or NBC did, and you had it. You know, you've had a number.
When all the big media companies were interested in getting into China, into business in China.
Yes, or you had it when they wanted deregulation here. You don't see the networks covering the deregulation effort here, even though it affects them dramatically and enriches their bottom line dramatically. I think the fact that there's misinformation about Iraq or Iraq's ties to al-Qaeda or Iraq's ties to 9/11, I don't think that's a deliberate policy of a corporation that says, I think we should get this out. I think it's a consequence of not having serious news staffs and doing serious news.
Jack, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I wouldn't for a minute suggest that it was a result of somebody saying, you've got to treat it this way. That's not my implication at all. Mine is precisely the point you were making, Ken, market bias.
And that's what I thought it was.
And the
that's
first rule of the market is don't cross your listeners.
So when you get a niche and you think you understand what it is, don't confuse, don't upset, don't put them off their breakfast.
We had a moment there where there was a majoritarian surge toward patriotism, toward trust in the administration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these news organizations with a lot to risk with stockholders and all the rest plainly were not challenging the administration sufficiently that these misconceptions, which even the administration, the president himself has said they were misconceptions, that these weren't being corrected. And I think the reason is you don't cross the audience. You just don't. When the tide is running that way, that's where your market is running.
Well, said they were misperceptions in a kind of muted after-the-fact way. Jack Beatty, Ken Auletta, author of Backstory Inside the Business of News. Let's invite our callers in. There are a lot who want to join us. Anna's calling from Plainville, Massachusetts. Hi, Anna. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to completely agree with Mr. Auletta that the media is market biased. I just left my job as a TV news producer late last summer because of that exact reason. You know, I went to an excellent J school, and it taught us everything from the necessity and profession of journalism to ethics and law. And when I got into the business, I found that it was all about lead-ins and entertainment value.
What did you find? Give us an example, Anna, of what really put you off.
I can go from Iraq all the way down, especially you guys were just talking about post September 11th, the patriotism. You know, there was really no balance. I mean, you see American flags in the corner of, you know, every station has a graphic that's an American flag. If this were China, you know, people would be saying it was state run, and that's almost what it was. There was really no questioning of anything, no room for debate. And even in the newsroom, you know, I really think the only people at this moment who really can own their stories and really can represent the watchdog part of the press are reporters. Because when you're a producer, you're just a show stacker and you're really working for the sales department and the general manager.
Anna, did you feel direct intervention from the business side of your news station, or was this just kind of absorbed by the news culture that you were part of?
Kind of. I mean, it's both. You know, I definitely felt, you know, when it sweeps, everybody knows about sweeps. It's time to, you know, work with the
make it jiggle
programming lead. Yeah. And but yeah, it is just the way it goes, especially in it's a commercial business. And it really broke my heart, in all honesty, because I knew that I wanted to be in the news since I was 15 and I didn't expect it to be like that. And after 3 years in the business, I'm trying to go somewhere else now. But you still do journalism, but more in depth, you know, something real.
Ken Auletta, you've been around the track. Give Anna a little career counseling here. She's got a broken heart. It sounds like not very deep into a career.
I hear that a lot from people, and I wish I had an antidote to it, except that there are places and people who practice inspiring journalism. And there are lots of it's you'll find some in television, you'll in radio, and in print. And on the web. And I just don't lose. I mean, you're the kind of people, Anna, we need to keep in the business. So don't leave.
Anna, thanks for calling. Sam's calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening, and I realized about a week and a half ago I finally canceled both my subscriptions to the Boston Globe and the New York Times. And having been away from it for about 2 weeks, I can honestly say that there's so much better news sources out there.
Better than those, but those are pretty good ones, as American newspapers go.
Well, that's the thing. You don't realize how awful they are until you go elsewhere. No, they're really terrible, and I'm going to say why. First of all, like most of the, I think our society, it's been taken over by MBAs, and the world was not always like that. This is a recent phenomenon in the last maybe 20 years or so that the MBAs have taken over the world. I mean, it's ubiquitous, and it's true of the news sources too. The New York
Times. So what does it mean you weren't getting in the Times, let's say?
Well, I think it's not only the depth that you don't get. It's also the fact that stories are dropped and you never hear them again. And when I've gone on the web and gone to more reliable news sources, you can pick those stories up. Like the, I can think of like three or four offhand. One is, I'm bad on names, but the outing of the guy whose wife was the CIA person.
Victoria Blaine.
Yeah. Story disappeared. The Enron story. That story, if you look back at it, that should be in the papers every day. It's a huge story. You can't get enough of it. It's like, doesn't exist.
Sam, hold on for a second. Can Aletta, can you speak to what Sam's raising here? I mean, he's at the point where...
Yeah, I did some reporting on the Joe Wilson and his wife,
Valerie,
CIA operative. Mm-hmm. That story broke in Robert Novak column in July, and Novak said he got it from two White House sources.
Right.
It got, outside of Newsday, initially, it got no press. It wasn't picked up. This was a violation of national security to out a CIA undercover operative.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back and read the White House briefings, which are all on the White House website, which is actually quite a good website, all the briefings are there, all the press conferences, all the president speeches, cabinet offices, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of information there. If you read those briefings, you'll see that the press aggressively that day and the next asked the press secretary about those leaks reported in the Novak column. It did not get in their copy. It did not appear in their newspapers, on their air, which is quite stunning. So I went back to, and then it didn't break until August, when it became a bit of a cause celeb.
Right, its moment,
and,
yep.
And they had to eventually now pick a special prosecutor to investigate how that leak was done. But I asked some of the reporters at the White House, you asked the questions at the briefing, why didn't you report on this? What happened to you? And they said, well, it's a good question, Ken. He said, you know, there were other issues going on that were big. Another reporter said, I thought I knew that she was a CIA operative, so it wasn't new to me. Another reporter finally said to me when I pressed him, good question. You know, I don't have a good answer for that. We should have.
Is that market bias? Is that fear? Is that... I mean, there's something going on there.
It's a bit of a mystery. I mean, there's probably lots of plausible explanations you can give, but I think another piece of it is going to be mysterious. Why is it that an issue takes hold? One issue takes hold and another doesn't. I would think that issue would be a fabulous issue. I mean, it's a question of breaking the law. It's abuse of power. It's endangering a life and maybe other people's lives.
And it may go right up to Karl Rove right next to the president, and it's not over yet.
Wilson alleged that Rove actually had a hand in leaking it. So I would think it should have been a big news story, but it wasn't. And then it did become a big news story. But what the alchemy of why something becomes news and something else doesn't, or a big issue, there's always a little mystery to that.
One way that things become a big story in the U.S. press, of course, is if the New York Times picks them up and champions them. But here our caller, Sam, and I'd like to get your response to this, Ken. He's saying he's just canceled his subscription to the New York Times and the Boston Globe, for that matter. If that's not good enough for Sam, where do you suggest he turn?
Well, I actually do think it's good enough. I think the Times is a great newspaper with great flaws, but it's a great newspaper and probably the world's best newspaper. But I think Sam is right that he should go on the web and search out for and find lots of alternative sources of information, including bloggers. And I think that's a great thing to do.
But is that enough? Is that enough, ultimately, Ken Auletta, to support a democratic citizenry? Can we all go off to one of the 1,000 million websites?
One of the great losses we have by not having common sources of information. It used to be when you had the networks providing information for 90% of the populace that you had a common source of information. But when you now bifurcate that, so some people get it from Fox News, which tends to have its own bias, and some people get it from CNN, and some people get it from bloggers, and some people get it from the New York Times, you don't have a common set of facts in a democracy, and you pay a price for that.
Michael's calling from Sturbridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Great.
I'm not in the news business, but I am a consumer of news, and I think there's a couple things, a couple points I want to make.
Mm-hmm.
As a follow-up to why does news hold, why does it take, being in a market that uses the news for different reasons, one of the reasons why I listen to the news is because I want to be able to use that information somehow in my life. If I can improve my life, that's great, I will use that. And looking at a lot of stories, I think a big thing that makes a big impact for a lot of folks will tune people in for certain individuals, maybe not others, but the topic of personal stories, issues that happen to families, missing children, things like that. Understanding what happened helps explain that there are, helps bring reality, especially as being a new parent, things that alerts me to the fact that I have to use certain precautions. These are the risks that are out there.
So Michael, it sounds like you're the target news consumer for lots of television news these days. Are you saying, don't bother me with AIDS in Africa or, offshore jobs in India. I want to know about a missing child in my backyard?
No, what I'm saying is I will find the sources that pertain to my interests. And I think those topics are fine for those individuals interested in those topics.
Yep.
But I think from we were talking earlier about, big business.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make it sexy. We have to entertain. I think being true to your audience, who your target audience is I think makes a bigger impact than trying to make it more entertaining.
Michael, we've got it. Ken Auletta, how about it? It almost sounds like the argument that the business side might make it a local newspaper saying, hey, come on, how much age in Africa do we need? Let's make this usable news for our readers right here in our hometown.
Well, I mean, if I pose the question this way, if I said, would you like your newspaper to be arranged by a market survey of what people are interested in, I think your listeners would say, no, we wouldn't want that to be. And if you ask the question another way, and it actually was asked at one point, I was on a panel, moderating a panel years ago with Andrew Grove, who was then the head of Intel.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going on as a tech, this was in the mid-90s, and he was saying, it was a panel at the American Newspaper Editors Association in Dallas, about 1,000 editors in the room, and he said, I said, Mr. Grove, what is the relevance of these editors in the room in the future, in the world of the Internet? What is their value? And he says, zero. He says, we don't need these editors. In the future, we don't need someone to be an intermediary, a middleman. The Internet is going to get rid of that, and people will choose what they want.
Was he right?
Let me switch forward. About 3 years later, on another panel that I'm moderating with Andy Grove, and I asked him the same question. And I said, this is what you said at the time. He said, I was totally wrong. He said, there's too much information. And the truth is, he said, one of the things I've learned is serendipity. He said, I didn't know that there was going to be a war in Bosnia and I'd be interested in that. Mm. If you asked me before, I would not have put that on my list. But I want a newspaper that tells me
what is important. Ken Auletta, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking with Ken Auletta, author of Backstory Inside the Business of News. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New Yorker magazine media writer Ken Auletta about the American news business and the journalism it produces and doesn't produce. His new book is Backstory Inside the Business of News. Jack Beatty's with us as well tonight. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Are you getting what you want, what you need from the American news media? Do you run to the mailbox for Ken Auletta's latest? And what do you think of his critique tonight? Where should Ken Auletta turn his magnifying glass? Next, we're at 1-800-423-8255. Rob's calling from Decorah, Iowa. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Good to have you.
I was wondering if your guests could address the story in the early 90s with corporate buyouts and how that reflects. My feeling was that it wasn't covered very critically at the time.
Well, Ken Auletta, this is sort of in your wheelhouse. You pay a lot of attention to the corporate world and to coverage. Did it catch your attention?
Oh, you're talking about corporate buyouts, not just media companies, all companies.
Yes. Yeah, all corporations.
And you're talking about the merging of and conglomeration of businesses, or are you talking about taking companies private? Let me be sure I understand the question before I answer it.
Well, it seemed like a lot of companies were buying up and becoming larger and larger conglomerations.
Right.
And
well,
that really been reported in a critical way.
Well, I actually think there has been a fair amount, probably not enough. I agree with that. But I remember writing a book in the mid-80s about this happening on Wall Street called Green Glory on Wall Street, mm-hmm. and how Lehman Brothers, the oldest private partnership, was gobbled up because the idea then, which, by the way, has spread everywhere, everyone wants to become Walmart today, is that you needed to be a financial supermarket in order to exist in the financial services industry. So you got the Merrill Lynch's and the Goldman Sachs and all these companies getting bigger and bigger. But the same thing has happened in the media world. And this notion that you have to be a global company, you have to be big in order to survive, led Ted Turner even, who was one of the great buccaneers, to say that he had to sell his company in 1995 to Time Warner. And that belief that bigness is good and bigness is powerful and bigness will lead to synergy and bigness will allow you to promote the different divisions, so therefore two companies getting together, 1 + 1 will really equal not 2 but 4.
But can it,
that's
it,
the, it, that's it, almost a religion.
But it sounds then that our caller is saying he didn't give enough critical coverage of just that kind of dynamic. Is it possible that if that became the religion of the news business, that the news business then became blind to it as perhaps a controversial factor in the economy at large?
It didn't become it became a religion of the business that owned the news business, and the news business to report it would be reporting on its own bosses. So one of the reasons I mentioned earlier that you had this battle about giving away of spectrum space several years ago, mm-hmm. or this battle this past year as to whether you should increase the number of stations, that whether you should further deregulate the rules so that station groups can own not 35% of the stations in the country, or mm-hmm. reaching 35% of the populace, but 45%. The networks didn't cover that. The TV stations, with rare exceptions, didn't cover that. You know, it was not a big story in many newspapers that stood to benefit from some of the rule changes that were going to take place. So I think that is a blatant kind of a conflict of interest that goes on and was underreported. So I agree with Rob and his argument there.
And if that kind of concentration would take place, it surely would only sort of turbocharge the direction of the news business that you're writing about here. Can I let it?
They're intertwined.
Yeah, David is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you tonight?
Great, thanks.
My question for your guest was if he thought there was some sort of technical development or stylistic development that needs to take place in journalism. Is there something, you know, the current journalism is the result of about 100 years of tradition and a way of framing stories. It seems to me that almost every story that you read of in the papers, and I'm a real news junkie, is very simple, is very simplistic. You never get the really full, messy complexity. And it seems like reporters spend a lot of time trying to boil down very complicated realities to simple narratives, and it just doesn't make sense anymore.
David, I see here on my screen that you're a criminal investigator who thinks
the news always gets it wrong. I'm a private detective. I investigate a lot of high-profile cases. And I've never seen one of the many cases that I've worked on that have been in the media accurately portrayed. It's always boiled down to a level of, a simple narrative. that can be digested in the story.
An eternal problem here or something to do with the new dynamic you're describing?
It's one I write about in my book. The form of journalism dictates the content, and by that I mean that the form that says, give me a headline, give me a lead, give it to me in 500 words in a newspaper story or 250 words in the average television script story, and do it quickly, do it right away, do it today, doesn't allow the time and the space to report the kind of conflict that David's talking about. Not conflict, I mean the complications.
The complexity.
That David's talking about, the complexity of an issue. So one of the complaints you hear when you talk to people in public life about the press is that you get it wrong. You simplify too much. And that's a complaint one hears from George W. Bush or from Bill Clinton or from mayors of our cities. And they have a right to say that because they write about that. So if I had to say one thing to an editor who ultimately is going to have to talk to his big boss in the sky, who's the business person who signs his check, is give your reporters more time to report and give them more space to be able to capture that complexity. If we're supposed to replicate the truth as best we can, and the truth is complicated, then we need more time and more space. But in fact, in the internet age, we have less time and we have less space because this is speeding up of the news cycle. And in fact, if you Gannett at some newspapers at Gannett, the people there, they say, hey, wait a second, why can't our reporters do two stories a day with the internet? They don't even have to go out and interview people. They can find the information on the internet.
Pump them out.
Yeah, and that's a huge problem.
Gerald's calling from Northport, Michigan. Hi, Gerald, you're on the air.
Hey. Well, it sounds like an allusion to decentralization as being never doubt the power of a few dedicated people on an issue that they fervently, you know, are dedicated to, which is the Margaret Mead rhetoric. I didn't get the quote right. But so what are we afraid of? If our prime directive is the health and well-being and the overall spiral of emergence of all of us at whatever level we're at, so that the article can be interpreted at different levels if it's written from a more comprehensive or integral, you know, approach.
But Gerald, if the bottom line doesn't have room for the time to even report it correctly, how do you get to the right expression of a piece of news?
Well, it's this instant gratification that we're all kind of like. That's the path of inertia, is that we're pushed toward this. But little do we know that if you take a little time and check in with that same, you know, relatively enlightened view that you're attracted to the day before may be reinforced by as things unfold.
Well, Gerald, we're all looking for enlightenment there. Ken Auletta, our time's running down. Where are you looking? Where's the beacon here?
I think one of the things you got to talk about is the cultural clash, and you somehow have to be able, journalists have to be able to communicate to the people who sign our checks, the business people. And we have to somehow cross that cultural divide that divides us. Business people like to talk about brand. And by brand, they mean what implicitly, they don't often know what they mean by brand, except they mean familiarity. But what a journalist means by brand is trust. If we don't have that trust, we undermine the brand. Somehow we have to convey to them that by not giving us the time to do the stories, to get the stories right, to capture the true complexity of a story, we are undermining the brand and therefore undermining your business.
Is there a business compulsion that's going to lead corporate heads around to that view? Or is that just pie in the sky? Is that dreaming, Ken?
Well, it may be dreaming, but I mean, I could think of several cases where it leads to some change of behavior. For instance, at the L.A. Times several years ago, when it was owned by the Times Mirror Company, not the Tribune Company, they did a special issue of their Los Angeles Times magazine with the Staples Center. And they didn't tell readers that the Staples Center was the sponsor or the advertiser behind that special issue. When that came out, when that was disclosed, it was so embarrassing that it led to fundamental changes at the L.A. Times, including fundamental changes in the ownership of the L.A. Times and in the editor of the New York Times. So they were all embarrassed. They were shamed by it. So shame, as it was in tribal days, is often a very powerful, yes. And so we need a little more press criticism, et cetera, et cetera.
We need a little more Ken Auletta, it sounds like. Ken, thanks very much for being with us tonight. Thanks for the new book.
Thank you.
Ken Auletta, author of Backstory, Inside the Business of News. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, an Afghan expatriate returns to help rebuild her homeland. This is On Point. Like many refugees who left Afghanistan over the past three decades, Rina Amiri has kept a close eye out for news of her war-torn homeland. 2 years ago, she returned, fresh from grad school, to help citizens communicate their needs to the Loya Jirga in June 2002. She was there again during the most recent Council of Afghan Tribal Elders and Other Leaders to debate a new constitution, paving the way for elections in 2004. In this radio diary, Rina Amiri talks about the role of women in the new Afghanistan and the cautious role of a returned native.
My family left Afghanistan when I was around the age of four. My family left not because they were working with the king. However, in parts of the world like Afghanistan, whether you choose to or not, you become politically affiliated simply because of who your family is, where you fall within the tribal lines. Because my family left for political reasons, they felt that it wasn't an active choice of leaving. They felt that they had left their identity behind forcibly. And there was always an expectation that the situation present itself, that we'd be able to return one day. What had happened to my family had happened to millions. As an Afghan woman myself, it's just a twist of fate. I and my family were able to leave when I was very young. Had I stayed in Afghanistan, my situation would have been starkly different. The way that I saw my role when I was returning to Afghanistan is that I would stand behind the average Afghans and help with the tools that I was able to acquire in the West for Afghans to amplify their own voices, to shape their own agenda of what they wanted to do. The way that I make my role less threatening is I dress exactly the way that the women and men there would expect me to dress. If it means wearing a veil, of course, I wear a veil every day. If it means wearing a burqa, I've worn a burqa. I was part of electing women to the emergency Loya Jirga. It was wonderful to see some of the stereotypes of Afghan women quickly dismantled. One of my first experiences is I was sent to Qandar, and there I met an Afghan woman who had spent the last several years at home because of the Taliban regime. She had been a teacher prior to that, and she marched into my office and said that she wanted elections for women. She was ready to participate. She had made photocopies of her picture, and she was undertaking a Western-style campaign to become a delegate to the emergency Loya Jirga, and she made it. I see that cadre of leadership. I see women who, as well as men, who have taken a slither of opportunity that's been available to them and have been able to widen that to a space in which they can create a new political forum for moderation and for a progressive element in Afghanistan. Constitutional Loya Jirga is where we've left off. It was, I think, a success. The fact that you've had disparate elements of the population who came together and spoke in one voice for the ratification of the Constitution, that's a success that should be celebrated. But it's also left some deep fissures in society. The country continues to be ethnically and regionally fragmented. The bond process and its next stage, the 2004 elections for the presidency in the parliament, is not an exit strategy. It's just the beginning. We're putting a fragile foundation in place for a country that's been torn asunder by decades of war.
Rina Amiri is political affairs officer for the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is on point.